Okay, I want to teach a class today on comforting the grieving, how God's people bring God's comfort to the brokenhearted. And in some ways, this is the more practical discussion, or maybe the more pastoral discussion than last week. So last week, I presented my thesis, which is specifically aimed at elementary age children who are grieving death. So I'm grateful for those of you that appreciated that and were interested in that. But I also realized that there were some components of that that were not broadly applicable, or there was a bit of a, like, there's an academic feel to presenting that. But what I hope to do today is come to a more personal and a more pastoral discussion of how we comfort those who are grieving. And I think this is a relevant topic probably always. I'm especially feeling the relevance for me personally. I was at two funerals this week, one on Monday, the church where I came from down in Kingsburg, another on Friday. And yeah, it never fails when I go to a funeral or when around people that are particularly grieving. And when I think about grieving, I am still talking particularly about death. Is what I want to talk about today. There is a particular sadness and pain that comes with death, that comes with a funeral, that is significant in the moment, and then it also has lasting consequences. And when we talk about grief, we talk about death, whether it was a parent, whether it was a child, whether it was a spouse, there is an aspect of grief that you can't even bring up the topic of death or grieving death. And I imagine even right now, there are people that come into your mind of somebody that you are maybe still affected by the grief of their loss. You're still feeling what we described last week, this profound sense of loss, and your whole body and your whole heart, your whole soul are still engaged in that. And that sense of loss, right? So we talk about how our bodies are affected by grief. So whether it is crying, whether it is something like fatigue, even think about just how fatiguing grieving is. So maybe it's a combination of other factors too. And the two funerals I went to this week, it wasn't that the people who died, one I was closer to than the other, but there's just a fatiguing factor to grief, isn't there? So on Friday, I came home from the funeral that I was at, and I actually just fell asleep on the couch for an hour. It was just, you know, all of the Monday and then all of Friday, and there's just something about it that just wears you down physically. And you've probably had that experience as well. It affects your whole body, whether it's your fatigue, whether it's crying. It affects our whole heart. So what you think about, what you feel, what you choose, all of these things are affected by grief. And the reality is that grief can threaten our beliefs. So what we think about can actually be threatened by grief. We might start thinking about the wrong things, right? And grief is this threat. At the very least, grief is a redirector for how we think, right? Grief tells you to think about this particular person, or sometimes grief tells you to think about a sad memory or a happy memory, but it's about what you're thinking. And grief can overwhelm our emotions. And so we say I didn't really want to feel sad. I didn't want to feel bad, but now I do. And, you know, I don't know if you knew that this was where we're going with today's Sunday school class, but you might be like, yeah, now I'm forced to face this. Like, when you think about grief and death, I feel something. I feel it strongly. Grief can sabotage our actions. We start making wrong choices. Grief can also lead to right choices, right? But our experience of grief affects us in our entire bodies and our entire hearts. It also affects things like our commitments and our relationships. So sometimes in grieving, we choose things like isolation. People pull away from others in grief. Other times in grief, people draw closer, and maybe families become more close-knit through a time of grief, and they get together and they share memories and time together that they haven't for a while. And a lot of times at a funeral, families that are spread out, maybe they come together for that. And so sometimes it's the opposite of isolation. Sometimes there's multiple people around, and sometimes that becomes its own burden, right? Because now there's more people gathered around, and that's a blessing, and it's also hard sometimes, right? So you have all these challenges that come with grieving death that affect our whole thinking, our feeling, our choosing. It affects affects our relationships, our values for things like security and comfort are challenged by death, right? Our longing for the sense of permanence is confronted by death and the grief that we feel over death. All these things are happening, and you have all experienced grief, and particularly grief over death, at various levels and with particular individuals. And as I think about 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 5, I want to remind you, when we think about us as God's people bringing God's comfort to the brokenhearted, what I hope to be encouraging you today is that grief, in particular grieving over death, is something for us as Christian people to carry together. That grief, God did not intend grief to be something that's experienced in isolation or individual. Instead, together we should be trying to bring God's comfort. And one of the ways we know that is from 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 5. Paul writes, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with a comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." I think this is a great passage on where the source of all true comfort comes from. God is the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He's the Father of mercies. And he is this amazing description of God, isn't it? That God is the God of all comfort. God of all comfort. People talk about the expression, all truth is God's truth. Right, and you have to understand that the right way. And so, but if you understand all truth is God's truth, you'll know what I'm saying when I say all comfort is God's comfort. All true comfort, all actual comfort is actually comfort from God. Now, I'm not saying there aren't false comforts that don't come from God, but all true comfort comes from God. So even the comfort that we get in being together during a hard time, that's a comfort that God has designed. Like, God made us this way, that whole like families drawing together thing, that's a God-designed comfort. All true comfort is comfort that comes from God. So just like all truth is God's truth, all comfort is God's comfort when it is this true. It doesn't even necessarily have to be like, oh, it's the Bible verse, but it's the way God is designed comfort. It all ultimately comes from him. He's the God of all comfort, and he comforts us in all our affliction. I think it's just a precious promise that affliction, this cover is obviously much broader than just death, but whatever your affliction is, God comforts us in all of our affliction. There's a comforting nature to God, which means that he is surely comforting you no matter what kind of affliction that you are in. Now, we don't always feel that as precisely, right? We're not always aware of that comfort. Sometimes we struggle to see it or to feel it, but God is the one who comforts us in all of our affliction. And he's doing that for a reason, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction. You hear again how broad that language is. Someone who is in any affliction. We're talking about particularly the affliction of grieving death, but we're comforted so that we can comfort those who are in any affliction. The idea of comfort is designed to be us together. There's a corporate or a community nature to comfort that we're supposed to be receiving and giving. Verse 5 tells us, well, we're comforting those who are in any affliction with a comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. So as you receive comfort from God, you are also able to comfort the people around you. Verse 5, for as we share abundantly in Christ's sufferings, so through Christ we share abundantly in comfort too. It's precious how Paul is connecting our unity with Christ. And unity with Christ means that you're going to share sufferings. If Christ suffered, then we should surely expect to suffer too, which is part of even how we understand comfort in grief, that this is not some kind of surprising or foreign or like, I can't believe this happened to me, right? Well, Christ suffered. And so as Christian people, we go, well, yeah, I understand that I'm going to suffer too, including suffering the grief of death, because Jesus also knew that. He knew that with his friendships, like with Lazarus, and he also knew personally what it was to die, right? So if Jesus suffered, then we as his followers should also expect that we share in those sufferings, but also through Christ, we share abundantly in comfort too. And I appreciate the abundantly there, right? We have abundant comfort in Christ, just like we have suffering along with him. So as I talk about comfort today and comforting the grieving, to reiterate something that I said last week, I feel like it's important for us to talk about comfort today, and some of these things I've shared with you before or in other contexts. I've talked before about comforting the grieving. I just feel like this is an important skill set that I need to develop and that you need to develop and keep developing. And so I say this is important. It's not because I think I know how to comfort the grieving and I need to tell you here's how to do it. It's something that I want to be able to do. I want to get better at. So I'm not sharing this as a, oh, here, let me tell you all the ways to comfort the grieving. It's such an important topic, and I'm like, we need to think together about this. And some of you, and we'll talk about this at the end, Lord willing, depending on our time, but I think some of you are particularly skilled at bringing comfort to others. And I just want you to know, like, we need you. We need that. As a church family, obviously the people in your life otherwise too, but as a church family, we need people that are skilled at bringing that comfort. There is an ability that some of you have to walk into an incredibly hard, maybe it's an emotionally volatile, it's a difficult circumstance, and you walk in and you don't flinch, you don't blink, you don't turn away from other people's pains. You walk towards them, and that's a gift. That's an ability that we need. That ability that you have to say the encouraging word, or that ability you have to not say anything and the person understands that you are comforting them, like, you're like, how does that work? How does somebody just being with you bring comfort? And yet some of you are skilled at that, where you walk into a situation where somebody is grieving and you apparently don't feel awkward that you're not saying anything, and the other person doesn't feel awkward either. And there is just comfort that is communicated through your body language and through the look on your face, and there's just something that some of you have. And I'm just saying we need you, and we all want to learn from you and get better at this. So what I want to do today, as we think about a difficult subject like grieving death, is I just want to give some ideas that maybe can be helpful to you as you think about grief, some suggestions. And then, again, Lord willing, if there's time by the end, I'd love to hear from you things that you have experienced that have been helpful to you, ways that people have been able to care for you, or that you've cared for others, so that we can consider that as well. Okay, so first encouragement to you when it comes to how are God's people bringing God's comfort. And so I'm really focusing on that, not just a general. I think even an unbeliever can bring comfort to somebody else in a variety of ways. But as God's people, where does God's comfort come from? A couple thoughts. One, I think we do need to set grief in a biblical context. So whether you're communicating this at the appropriate time, or you're just walking into a situation like grief with this awareness, when I say the biblical context, we need to know what is true about death. Because people need to be able to grieve holistically. Like, there needs to be a comprehensive, like, how are we understanding grief? And just one example of what I mean by biblical context, you could see this a number of ways, but let's just take the overarching storyline of the whole Bible. If we're going to try to describe the whole, like, how do we summarize the whole Bible? What's the big story? You could describe the whole Bible in these four points. All right? Creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. So if you know those four things, you know the storyline of the entire Bible, right? So obviously there's a ton of details in that, but these four things describe the entire Bible. So you got creation in Genesis 1 and 2. And really the theme of creation in Genesis 1 and 2 is that it was good. You say, like, okay, well, how does this help as we think about grief and we think about death? Well, remember that in Genesis 1 and 2, everything was good, and already the threat of death hung over that good reality, right? Because already God had told Adam and Eve that if they ate from that fruit and the day that they did it, they would die. So already, even in this perfect environment, this paradise environment in the garden, everything is good. And yet, the idea of death and grief is already, it's already there. It's already present. And it's threatening this very good arrangement of God walking with Adam and Eve and everything being perfect between them and all of creation. But everything is good, and yet if they sin, then death will come. So grief and the pain of things like death are the response to us wishing that creation was still good. Isn't that part of it? Like, we wish that we were still in a garden environment where there was no death, there was no disease, there was no sadness. And here's part of the reason that I'm saying this. God made us for that good environment. Right? Like, God made us for that kind of perfection. So your longing for things to be right and perfect is God built. Like, God made us to wish that all was right, because that's how he originally made Adam and Eve. He did make them, and it was all very good. So when people grieve and they feel a sense of loss in death, and of course it could be applied, I guess, to other things as well, but when we feel that sense of loss, we're recognizing things aren't good anymore, in a sense, right? Things are broken, and that grief is good and right, as it's a recognition of, I long for the day when everything was good and right. Back then, and obviously we'll talk in restoration of longing for the day when Jesus comes and fixes it all, but there's this longing in the human heart for, I wish there was no such thing as death, I wish all was good. And I'm just saying, I think that lines up, I think, with Genesis 1 and 2. This is how God made us. He made us for everything to be right. Right? Then we get to Genesis 3, and you get the fall, and now we have the explanation, obviously from a biblical standpoint, we have the explanation of where death comes from anyway. I alluded to this last week, but again, it's only a biblical worldview that can explain why there's actually dying. Right? Like, why is there death? And the evolutionary viewpoint doesn't actually have any kind of great explanation of why there's death. But as Christians, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. We have an explanation for where death came from. So when we say this, we're not necessarily saying this particular person died because they committed one particular sin. Right? And we're not accusing those who have died of, you did this one sin, now you died because of it. What we're saying is, we have all sinned and all will die. It's the universal law version of sin, not you committed this one particular sin. It's that all of us have sinned. And now we have an explanation for why there is sin and death and disease. Why is everything broken anyway? Because we have Genesis 3, we have verses like Romans 5:12. So we know. We don't have to question why is there death and why is there dying. The wages of sin is death. That doesn't need to be a cold reality. This is how we understand ourselves and our world. Why is there dying? Because the wages of sin is death. This is the payment for sin. This is the world that we live in. So in creation, it was all good. In the fall, it's ruined. But the two other major biblical movements in the story, we got creation and fall, but then you have redemption, particularly the redemption that has worked in Jesus. Jesus saves. And this salvation is connected to the idea of restoration, but while we have genuine salvation now, we wait for the final restoration when Jesus recreates and he makes everything right. So the restoration that we look forward to in places like Revelation 21, when we have this new heavens and this new earth, and 1 Thessalonians 4, when we get to see him, we become like him because we see him as he is, in a moment we're changed, right? That kind of recreation. So think about... we're not even talking about views of the rapture, for instance. John and I had a conversation this week about that. I'm not talking about that, but think about that moment when Christians who are alive instantly receive a glorified body. That's a recreation, right? And those who were dead, whose bodies have even, by that point, I mean, there's Christian bodies that have totally decomposed, they are recreated. Think about how there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. There is a recreation that is happening. Right? And Jesus is going to recreate what was all lost and broken in the fall in the garden, and he's going to make it all new, including our bodies and including the universe. He recreates. And this is part of the beautiful biblical storyline. Right? So our hearts long for that recreation while we have to live in the realities of fall now, but we live in the realities of fall not apart from the wonderful reality that Jesus saves. So we experience salvation of our souls while we await the full salvation of our bodies. And all those things help us set grief in its context. Because if we didn't have any context for Jesus recreating, the idea of being saved in this life would have extremely limited value. It had extremely limited comfort. Well, you can be a follower of Jesus in this life. Then what? You're like, well, how much good is that? Paul tells us how much good that is in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, if that's your understanding of the gospel and of Christ, you are the most pitiful person on the planet. Of all people, you're most to be pitied. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, you're not going to rise from the dead. That is a pitiful religion that says, yeah, believe in Jesus, follow all these rules, and then when you die, game over. Right? And that's a pitiful way of living. But he says, no. So we need to set grief in its context. And it's right for us to say, this stinks. I hate that this is how it is. We hate death. We hate that our world is broken. And at the same time, Jesus has saved. He is saving. And he will save because of this biblical context. All right. So we need to preach that to ourselves. We need to communicate that to our family members. Communicate that to other believing people. And that's just one example of knowing what is true about death. That's just using the biblical storyline. Obviously, there's tons of passages about grieving and death and dying all throughout Genesis to Revelation. But that's just an example of using the entire storyline of creation and fall and redemption and restoration. It helps us set grief in its context. All right. We encourage us to try to show faithful love to those who are grieving. There's something about knowing that you're loved and not alone that allows people to grieve. I don't know even the right word, to grieve safely, to grieve in an understanding way. I'm not by myself. I'm not doing this grief alone. All right. As you're trying to show faithful love, what are some things that you do say? I think we should express our love and sorrow to people who are grieving. And I hope even right now, I hope your brains are engaged even for the time when I ask you what are some effective ways that you've cared for others and that others have cared for you. But I do think that we should express love and sorrow to the grieving. So one of the expressions that I use when I'm talking to somebody at a funeral is, I'm so sorry for your sadness. Right? That's a way of me showing, like, I'm trying to express care for you. So again, you might have better words, better language. I try to not say I'm sorry for your loss, but maybe that's a fine thing to say. I'm trying to find, like, what is this person, what are they feeling that I want to try to address? What you're feeling right now is sadness. If they were feeling something else, then I would try to talk to that too. Usually in the funeral, it seems like it's sadness. You're trying to express love and sorrow to the person who is grieving. Part of that expression of love is also when we talk about what are some of your happy memories of the person who died. That's an expression of love. Well, tell me a story about so-and-so. It's just a way of trying to express love. This is the Revelation. It's the Romans 12:15. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. There's this communal nature to us weeping together. So we express our love. What are other ways you can do that besides particular, I don't know, sentences or words you say? We can pray. That's an expression of love and sorrow for somebody who's grieving. So whatever your prayer list looks like, I think when there's an announcement, when announcement hits, you know, from a Sunday school class or the ladies group me that so-and-so has died, that grief should make it onto your prayer list and probably make it to the top of your prayer list probably for a little while. It should become something that, like, hey, for these next 3 weeks or 4 weeks, this is going to be something I'm going to consistently give myself to praying for. And I think if we did that, it would also help us. If we're praying for people who are grieving, it helps us when we see them. We're already primed to try to express care for them. We're ready for that moment. It shows them that they're not forgotten. Their grief is not. We didn't overlook it. Like, we remember because we've been praying. I think you can apply that in broader than just the immediate, but we should be praying for people who are grieving. As God brings people to your mind that are grieving, and even if the loss, the death has been months or even years, we should be praying for one another as we're grieving. I also think that's another reason, if we'll give ourselves to praying, particularly for somebody who's grieving, for that 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, you're more likely to remember down the road, oh yeah, that's right, I prayed for them. You know, for a month, I prayed for them every day for a month. And so then 2 years down the road, that memory might still be in your head and you go like, oh, I just remembered that person. I should pray for them again because of their grief. Okay, so we should pray. Calling is a way to express love and sorrow. We live in a day of cell phones and total curiosity. How many of you got a landline in the house? I'm putting my hand down because I don't have one of those. Anybody got a landline in the house? Oh, we got a landline. All right, got a grand total of one landline. All right, amazing. All right, two. All right, we got two landlines. You don't have to be embarrassed. It's all right. It's okay to have a landline.
Emergency call.
Emergency call, right? So that's what like landlines have been reduced to largely, is either non-existent or emergency call. We live in a day of cell phones, which is both instant access, but here's the thing. If the person doesn't want to answer your call, they're just going to click the little deny button or the reject button, and that's fine. And if they answer, then it's because they wanted to hear your voice and they wanted to hear you, right? So call. Someone's grieving. You're like, well, I'm not sure if it's going to bother them. They'll have their ringer off if they don't want to be bothered, right? They'll put their phone back in their pocket, and they'll not have had their phone because it's sitting on the counter and they didn't want to talk to anybody, and so they're in the other room because they don't even want to hear that thing vibrate. Well, then they won't answer, right? But let's try. Let's call, right? And if they answer, then great. And if they don't, fine. I'm going to try to leave as loving a message as I can, and so we can call, right? We can go. We can show up on somebody's doorstep. You can give them a couple minutes heads up or not. You can just go. I'm going to go to that hospital. I'm going to go to the emergency room. I'm going to, whatever, just go. And if they don't want you there, then hopefully you'll have the social awareness that they don't want you there. You'll figure it out. And maybe you'll go and they will be so happy that you're there. Maybe you'll go and it'll just be 10 minutes. It's just 10 minutes. And you're like, after that 10 minutes, you're like, yeah, I think this is all that they either needed or wanted. And I'm going to kindly excuse myself. You're certainly not trying to ingratiate yourself, or you know. But let's go. Let's go. Let's knock on the door. Let's go to the house. Let's go to the emergency room, and then see. All right. You can write. So that's true. Whether that's writing a text message, again, because of the world we live in, you could write a handwritten note if you have that ability. You can write. So it's just, how can we express love and sorrow to the person that's grieving? When it's right, I'm just talking about one of what do you say? We can remind the grieving of anchors for truth. And this is certainly not intended to be like you should go preach to people who are in the middle of grieving. That's not what I mean. If it's already a believing person, I think they'll be encouraged by you referencing scripture and giving them a reminder. When someone's grieving, it's not the time to give them a lesson, right? That's what I mean by like preaching. I mean, like, it's not the time to sermonize when someone is grieving. When it's a reminder, that's why I try to use that word. We're just reminding the grieving of anchors for truth. And it needs to be the right time and the right way, but there are things that grieving people love to hear. God will never leave you or forsake you, Hebrews 13:5. Like, that is a comfort. Like, I am not left alone. He cares. God is the ultimate source of comfort, 2 Corinthians, like we looked at. John 11, the whole chapter, but 1 through 45, Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Think about how just reminding somebody who's grieving, Jesus is the resurrection and life. And maybe you don't have to say too much more than that. You can just say, Jesus is the resurrection to life. Think about how that ministers comfort to a believing person who's grieving the death of a believing person. And they go, that is true. And you didn't preach at them. You didn't sermonize. You just reminded them this is what's true. All right. Jesus knows the experience of grief. So Hebrews 4:14-16. I've said this before, but I don't know how many people, when they're talking about grieving death, even in the moment, will say, I'm so sorry to be getting emotional right now. Right? It's just such a reaction. Jesus knows the experience of grief. Those tears that you're crying, Jesus knows this. He actually cried tears just like yours. So Jesus knows the experience of grief is a comfort. God is good and all-powerful. That can be an anchor for truth. God didn't lose any of his power because the person you love died, and God didn't lose any of his goodness. Neither of those things stop being true because the person you love died. As painful as it is, God is still good. And as painful as it is, God is still all-powerful. He didn't suddenly... Death is not the thing that is stronger than God. And death suddenly came and it took away God's sovereignty and it took away God's power. And God is just as upset about it as you are. No, God's all-powerful, right? So these kind of reminders. And surely there's others, but those are just examples of the kinds of reminding we can do. We can help the grieving face the process of grief. When I say the process of grief, I think I included it on your worksheet. There are some people who have described grief as a series of stages, and I'm not fully committed to like exact stages of grief. In fact, there's lots of people that would say, we need to be careful that we don't describe grief as something that is these very discrete, concrete stages, where in one moment you're feeling this one thing that is denial, and then you get to move on to the next stage, which is anger, and then you get to move on to bargaining, and then you get to move on to depression, and finally you get to acceptance, and presto, you finished your grief journey, right? Grief is not a linear, like, from this dot to this dot to this dot. It's not how grief works. I just think that these observations that people have done, that grieving people experience things like denial and anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, I just think that's useful to say, this is human experience. People have experienced these kinds of things, and that's why it's helpful for us to know that. I'm not saying these are the only categories of things that people experience when they grieve. It's just that these are observable human experiences, and so these may not be all of them, and they're certainly not linear stages, but these are kinds of things that people who are grieving are going to experience and continue to experience. So that's why, like, the process of grief is probably better language, I think, than stages that make it sound like you can go from point A to point B. But there's this whole kind of roller coaster cycle that happens in the process of grief, right? But if we were to take these kind of classic categories, you have things like denial. One of the things that I read even for my thesis, and it was too inflammatory for me to not notice it and be bothered by it. I was reading in one secular source when it came to denial. Religion is the clearest example of denial, right? Religion is how people deny that death happened. There is no such thing as resurrection, and so this is the clearest example of denial. People that believe in some kind of afterlife are the people that are experiencing denial, right? So I guess if you follow that train of thought, the best way to deal with that is for you to become irreligious and stop believing in the resurrection, right? So that is a tact. I'm just saying there's different ways we explain denial. I think the idea of denial is better expressed in when people say things like, I can't believe this happened, right? That's somebody's, they're like, their brain's trying to wrestle with this, like, They're denying that this happened. It's as if he's still here. It's as if she's still there. Right? That's more kind of the idea that I think of when I think about denial. And we all know that death is real. So think about just the denial that's in us as Christian people. We all know that death is real. We just don't expect it to hit us, right? Or our family or our loved ones. Like, all of you sitting here right now, you know that death is real. You all know that you're going to die. Which means that you know that if you have children, you know that your children are going to die. If you have parents that are alive, you know your parents. Like, we all know this. But we go day after day not expecting that to happen, because for a bunch of days it hasn't happened. And we live kind of in this, like, permanent state of denial until all of a sudden death forces us to face this, what we knew to be true, which is I'm going to die and we're all going to die. All right? So this denial, there is a... 9:56. Sorry. There is a fog that comes to grief that I think is mixed in with this idea of denial. A lot of people that are grieving experience this, like, I call it fog. It's just like, it's like brain fog. It's like, I just can't see straight. I just can't think straight. Like, it's just part of how we have to come alongside people and help them experience and process that grief. Right. Anger, I'll just quickly skip over that, but James 1:20, the anger man does not produce the righteousness of God. We have to be super careful at allowing anger, right? So anger is our body and heart's response to something that is unrighteous or unjust. It very easily turns into something that is sinful. So we just have to be really careful about the experience of anger. What are some things you don't say, just because of the sake of time? I'm going to... fast forward. What are things that you don't say? Please don't say, I know exactly how you feel. That's never a good thing to say in any counseling situation. It's certainly not true or not a good idea to say when someone's grieving death. You don't know exactly how they feel. You might even know things about the person who died. You might know something about the person who's grieving, their relationship with the person who died. You say, I know exactly how you feel because one of their loved ones died, and you don't know that they might be feeling something like disappointment. You might not know that there was actually some big brokenness in that relationship, and so they're feeling the fracture of that, and so they even feel a sense of, like, betrayal or, like, animosity, or there's all kinds of things you don't know what people are feeling. So please don't say, I know exactly how you feel. please don't ever say, I think you should move on with your life. Like, why would you tell somebody that? Like, they are grieving. This is life. And I'm saying these things, and I hope you go like, well, I would never say that. But people have said these things. That's why they're here, is because people have said these kinds of things to other people. And Christian people have said these things to other Christian people. Please don't say those kinds of things. Here's the spiritual, this is all for your good. Just praise Jesus and it'll all turn out all right. Right? So yes, God works everything together for good. But I'm not sure that the funeral home is the place where you like lay that verse on somebody and say, here you go. God works all things together for good. My loved one is in this casket and you're just gonna like, come on. There's other verses in the Bible. There's ways that we can be comforting, which is not to say that we're not comforted by the reality of God's sovereignty and him working all things out for good. But there's just something that can be like calloused and forced about that. Here is what surely is the worst one of the list. Do you think there's unconfessed sin in your life? It's like, really? We're gonna add guilt and like you're maybe to blame? Because here's the thing. This is certainly true of children, and I assume it to be true about adults, but definitely in some of the research I did with kids, kids often feel that death is their fault. Like they'll feel as if they're to blame. Right? And so the Christian version of do you think there's unconfessed sin is actually like capitalizing on that, and it's actually saying like maybe you are in some way to blame. Did I tell you a story about I was on a chaplain call 3 weeks ago, and super sad, this girl's aunt died in their home. They weren't sure why, so they had to treat it like a crime scene. And so the family is just sitting in the living room while the woman's body is there on the stairs, and their 13-year-old was the one who found her. And 13-year-old was just sobbing there on the couch. So I just walk into this situation. I don't know this family. It's just, you know, it's a family of Manteca with the Manteca PD. And so I watched this 13-year-old just like bawling her eyes out. And so after I'd been there for a while, I just went over and I sat next to her. And I said, she's the one that called 911. She's like, all of that. And I said, do you know that you did everything that you can? You did a great job. I said, you did a wonderful job today. And she said, if only I would have known CPR. If only I would have come down the stairs sooner. She started listing. What she was saying is, it's my fault that Auntie is dead, right? So instantly you move into, this is not your fault. Like you were so brave. You did so many things right, right? And I didn't know this girl. Literally the first thing I'd ever said to her is, you know that you did such a great job. And she immediately went to, it's my fault. This is how we operate. So if we're gonna lay that on somebody, oh, it's probably because of your unconfessed sin or you, that's a terrible thing to put on people. All right, what are we trying to do? We're trying to balance closeness and imposition. So we want to get close to people without imposing on them. And that is a balancing act, right? There's times when people want you in their living room. There's times when people want you out of their living room. And we're trying to balance that. We're trying to provide physical care. That's why we have things like a meal train whatever. We'll take care of your grass while you're grieving. We're trying to bring physical care. Here's food. Can we get you a gas card so you don't have to worry? Can I go fill up your car with gas? I mean, whatever. We're trying to bring physical care. And then faithful friendship is what we're trying to bring to people. Okay? All right, I have a section here on grieving children, although some of this is what I talked about last week. So I will just, I'll quickly move through. Just as we think about children, just a reminder that I think this is true, that children grieve longer and harder, but differently from adults. So we have to consider the mental development of a child. Children think in concrete terms, not abstract. They learn over time that death is something that is universal and is irreversible and it's comprehensive. This means I can no longer talk to granddad ever. He's not going to move. He's not going to play ball with me. Like they learn that this is not a situation that is going to change and it's affected everything, but they learn over time. And a lot of times children will just say bluntly whatever it is that they're thinking. And so we have to consider the mental development. Where is this child at mentally? Means that you have to have come to some clear conclusions yourself about grief and death, or else you're not going to have any kind of perspective to share with a child who's developing. Like, so I'm talking particularly to those of us in the room who are adults, like, our brains aren't still developing. We should have come to conclusions about death and grief so that we can then teach another generation what those things are. Okay? And you've got children that are still growing their ability to grasp abstract language, and so we should have really clear, concrete language that we can use. Okay. Here's some examples. If this helps, I know I'm focusing on kids again, but saying things like, your grandfather's heart stopped beating and so his body does not work anymore. That's just an example of like, what's some kind of language that we can give a child to have some kind of physical understanding of death. If you want to go a little more theologically, her spirit is not with her body anymore. Now you're getting a theological category of like, oh, we are both body and spirit. Her spirit's not with the body anymore. We need to try to be clear. I've mentioned Jessica's house multiple times. I appreciate their training material. Here's how they recommend explaining something really difficult like suicide. So what kind of language do we give to children? Here's what they said. For 3 to 6-year-olds, they made their own bodies stop working. Right? That's a way of trying to communicate clearly and physically without saying too much nor too little. They made their own bodies stop working. For 7 through 11-year-olds, your person caused their own death. This is called suicide. To 12 to 17-year-olds, they died by suicide or he killed himself. And it's that kind of language that is bringing clarity and information to children that they need to be able to process what's happening. So just have to remember that children may have never experienced death before. That funeral might be that first funeral. And so, of course, they're not going to understand what's going on or have that life experience before. All right. So we should also remember the emotional attention span of a child. It's something we've talked about before. Children go in and out of grief. Children often fear abandonment, and so that becomes a part of their emotions. And they lack the vocabulary or self-awareness of emotions. There's times when kids can't even tell you what they're feeling. Real simple illustration of things that you can do. You could just draw a heart on a piece of paper and give a couple colored crayons to a kid and say, all right, red is, color red, whatever part of your heart feels angry right now. Color blue for whatever part feels sad. Color purple for whatever part is confused. And then color yellow, anything else that you're thinking. And then can you tell me, like, hey, why did you color this part yellow? What was that? You're trying to give them vocabulary, trying to let them express, right? So maybe adults don't need a color in a heart to say what they're feeling, but frankly, some of the times you might, because you may not be assessing what it is that you're feeling, and you never thought about it until somebody slides a heart across the table and goes, go ahead, give this emotion a color, and I want you to show me. Is that 50% of your heart right now? Is it just this tiny little sliver? Like, they color the whole thing in, like, black, and you're like, okay, what's going on here? Like, right, it's a way of trying to, like, let's get to what's going on the inside, okay? All right. Yeah, I didn't get anywhere close to through the notes. I do want to take the last. It's only 4 more minutes, and I really wanted us to have more time. But I do want to hear from you. Can you share with us? Maybe you had an experience of grief, and somebody said something that was particularly helpful to you while you were grieving, or maybe there's ways that you have comforted other people and you go like, oh, I know that this has been really well responded to. So looking for ways that you've been comforted or ways that you know people have received comfort from what you've said or done. All right, so I know we don't have a ton of time, so try to keep it brief, but let's try to help each other. What are some things someone has said or done for you or that you have said or done for someone else that you know has been effective? Anything? Yes.
So when my parents passed away, for the funeral, the ones who received mine their funeral. I appreciate when people came by and they said, I remember when your dad did this, mm-hmm. your mom did this. I mean, it was more than just, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was kind of, well, that was a, yeah, I can appreciate, you know, what they were saying. It just kind of encouraged me and kind of lifted me up through that whole time.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. That's really good. What else? Yeah, Joe.
When we lost my father-in-law, for my mother-in-law and their wife, some people that were particularly close to us, it didn't happen immediately, but in time, like some of the actual like physical responses to grief or extreme stress, that they were feeling. Like, you talk about like the brain fog, you know, for my mother-in-law. I think she thought there was a problem with her because she went days, probably months, of like just living in a fog and didn't realize that that was a natural reaction to things. You know, like somebody who had gone through it and talked to her about it.
Yeah.
And that was just very helpful, you know, just a loving, practical conversation.
Yeah, it's good.
When I was like 20, we had a close family friend commit suicide, and I wanted to mention this last time too. Like, my brother, I mean, he was an adult, he was over 18, but it really affected him. Mm. And till this day, he's now 40. Like, it's been a big part of his life. And I don't know, like, there's not a lot of help. And then when people say stuff like, just get over it, you know, like, it really creates big issues.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, like, at that age, even though you're an adult, you're still not, your mind doesn't work right.
Yeah.
And it really does set a foundation for the future, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that. That's part of the reason that I think it matters so much to me that we try to help kids process grief and death. And that's also why it matters to talk about this today, not just for kids, but for all of us. Like, there are, we talk about like patterns being set or like things that are not addressed in a timely way. The problems that creates down the road are can be enormous. So not insurmountable. But I just think that is a reality that if we're not helping kids grieve or even other adults, the repercussions can be significant. So as difficult as it can be to try to figure out how to comfort somebody, as much as we go like, I'm not sure who's good at this, but if we don't try, the ripple effects are really significant. So appreciate you sharing that. Other thoughts? Yeah, Seth.
Grief is best done immediately. And when it's prolonged or delayed, it complicates things so much. I can, you know, I work with a lot of kids that a lot of it has nothing to do with grief, but I've never worked with a single kid who's been to a funeral.
Hmm.
And it's interesting how many of the kids end up talking about death, whether it's suicide or just family members, even parents that have died, that they were never told, they were lied to, or they were told, they were aware of it, but they weren't allowed to go to the funeral.
Yeah.
Because their parents were trying to protect them. And it just made it confusing, complicated. And I can't help but think, if they weren't allowed to go to the funeral, how were they helped through that grieving process?
Yeah.
Or was it, we don't want it to be any more difficult for them, so we're just going to kind of dance around that part of it, and then they're left all alone.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's to be left alone, you think, for a kid who's still trying to make sense of the world and of themselves, and kids will fill in the blanks themselves. Mm-hmm. So they're either going to fill it in with good and right information, or they're going to make something up. Right? Like, kids are going to try to interpret the world around them. You do this as an adult. You're always interpreting the world around you. It's just a kid still in the process of development. So they're going to come up with what they think is the answer, even if they're just totally wrong. So, yeah.
And for a kid, usually that's self-blame.
Yeah.
Whether it's death or divorce or whatever, they go internal.
Yeah.
And then they become that 40-year-old who just struggles.
Yeah.
Eric and I were talking about this in a mall car trip on the other day. So we were talking about last week and this, and, you know, like how to have conversations with the kids and all that. And we were talking about, I think that leads to what you're speaking about, even if it's true adult relationships, not just kids, but like how do you go and have these conversations with kids, you know, give them the coloring sheet about the heart and all these things. Like, when you never have those kind of conversations in general, when you're just not in close relationship with your kids or another adult, you know, like now all of a sudden we're facing trauma and something traumatic has happened, and like, the first time in my life I'm gonna ask one of my kids, tell me what you're feeling inside.
Right.
How do you think that's going to go?
Right.
And, I mean, and maybe it's a strike. You know, I mean, so I'm not saying, like, don't do it, but do the work up front ahead of time. So we all know that we are going to face something in life, whether it's death or something else. It's going to be difficult, right? I think it's a lot. I think we're doing our kids and our adult friends and, you know, family mates and everything like that a better service by establishing those relationships and those truths up front, and then work through them.
I think that's a good call on kids. It's also a good call for us to think about how we're relating to one another within our church family. So like not everyone, and even in a church of our size, not everyone can be as close as everyone else, right? We're already at that point where you're not going to be perfectly close with everyone. But who do you know? Who knows you? Who's investing in you and you're investing in them? Because we need one another. And that moment of trauma, it's too late to build a relationship then, right? Now it's time for us to do that. So, I think that's a good call. It's part of the like holistic approach to grief is building relationships, living life the way God made us within community is part of how we are helping with grief down the road. We just haven't gotten there yet. Obviously some of us have, but you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, let's build those relationships now within community, within our church, so that when the time comes, there's a weight, there's a strength that's ready to go. So,
what about redirecting a child to someone who can help if you don't have that experience?
Yeah, I think that's great. So whether it's maybe they have a Sunday school teacher, maybe there's a teacher at school that a kid has made a good connection with, and that teacher be willing to have a conversation with them. Obviously, you hope for with kids, like parents are the number one impact on any child's life. So, you want that to happen, but sometimes there's a grandma who's really close or an uncle so finding those people, you don't have to bear the weight of every single person's grief as significantly as somebody else's, right? Like emotionally, we don't have the capacity to care for everybody's grief. Like you can't do that. You know too many people to carry everybody's grief. But if you are in a right relationship, if you do have that, steward the relationships that you have, right? You don't have to carry everyone's grief as significantly as an ex-person's, but all of us can contribute, and all of us can help. And some people you have a much deeper relationship with that you need to be ready to go. So don't feel like you have to carry every kid's grief or every individual's grief. But it's similar, I don't know, in some ways, is it similar kind of like to evangelism? Like, don't we want opportunities though? I want to evangelize people that I really know, but you might also get a chance to just make one kind of stray random comment to somebody who's grieving and it becomes extremely meaningful, whether it's a kid or somebody else. So let's not look down on the one kind of random comment. Let's also have real relationships so that we can, you know, have more than just one random comment. Okay? All right, maybe two last things. Okay, one last thing.
It'll be really quick. Just sort of branching off of what Daryl said. So I've lost a brother and a brother-in-law, and they both had small kids. And I just know over the years, as a family, we've talked a lot about how their dads felt about them. And even, like, I have a nephew who's 40 years old, and he lost his dad when he was 5. But still to this day when I see him, I talk about his dad and how much his dad would be proud of him. And I just think reminding people, I know that they have said often to me, thanks for reminding him that my dad was a real person. And so I think over the years that grief is a reminder that they're, you know, so anyway.
Yeah, that's good. I think that's good. Okay, thanks for your time and attention to a difficult subject, and I hope some of this is useful, and let's keep trying to get better at this. All right, we'll see you in the worship service.